Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and good afternoon. Welcome to our podcast here on Thursday. I'd like to introduce Mr. Rich Kahn. He is the CEO and the co-founder of Anira.io. They are a cybersecurity company based out of Middletown, Delaware. Rich, thanks for your time, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. We've been looking up your background on LinkedIn, did some Google searching. You seem to have a very deep background in both cybersecurity and marketing. Never really had that in a podcast guest before. Could you please elaborate more on your career highlights and how you kind of got started in this unique mix of cyber and marketing?
Well, I mean, the best way to look at it is I started my first digital marketing firm back in 1993. 2 years after the internet was basically public, you know, for the public to use. And it started off as an email newsletter. And I was just enthralled with the internet and how things were evolving. So I started writing about it and putting a newsletter together once a week. And then had the idea, you know what, let me charge people to put, you know, an ad inside my newsletter. And that's how I started my first marketing firm back in 93. So I've been doing marketing for a long time. And late 90s, early 2000s, I started to started buying traffic on the internet and just seeing some anomalies around what was going on. I mean, I was buying traffic and selling traffic for a long time prior to that, but I really started doing it personally myself and actually having access to performance-based data. So when that happened, I could start to see some anomalies in the data, started realizing there's something going on here, and I figured it was fraud. So I started running some code to see if I can understand what was going on, and sure enough, it was ad fraud. So people were basically trying to impersonate other people to try to perpetrate this fraud. So I think I started writing the first initial code base back in 2005. And as I started producing this product or this service, I was able to improve the quality of the campaigns that I was spending money on and make a higher ROI. So I was making more money and it started growing. So as that started to grow, I continued to develop the fraud tool, especially as fraud continues to evolve, which is a constant. And that kind of led into Anora. We've been working on the Anora project basically since 2005, so 15 years now. And after, you know, using it personally myself for a bunch of different things, realized, you know, this has a good need in the marketplace. And so we did some comparative testing against competition back in 2015, realized we had a better solution, and then did some beta testing with it, realized, you know, clients really loved it and there was a demand for it. So we kind of launched the whole thing in April of 2017 as a fraud solution because we feel this is a great place to be, especially with fraud exploding on the market.
Excellent. Now, let's do a deep dive into your company. So explain to us what exactly is Anira, your company. But before that, how did you get the name Anira? What does it exactly mean?
Well, my past companies, we used to pick names or different things or have mascots. And we had this, since we're on a podcast, give a little bit of the history here. I had moved from New York. I'm born and raised in New York, and my wife and I and the kids moved down to Delaware. We moved on to Frog Hollow Golf Course. So when we were starting looking at for our advertising company, we were looking for a mascot. We chose the frog. And the reason for that was when we were building a house, right on the golf course in Frog Hollow Golf Course, a large frog jumped into the foundation when it was built and while it was setting. So you couldn't get in there to get it out because it was still wet cement, and the frog passed away. So when we finished building the house, we dedicated a bathroom in the house right above where the frog passed away to the frog. So it was green themed out. It had frog, you know, knickknacks and whatnot all over the place. So when we sat down to come up with a mascot for our first company, we decided to go with a frog. So as we were building Anora, and Anora got its start in all that, we figured we want to have some tie back to the original company. So Anora became the name, which is actually the classification for a frog in the animal kingdom. So if you type in Anora in Google, you'll see a bunch of stuff about frogs and stuff like that. And it was a short name, and it had a nice ring to it, and it's that non-traditional .com company. Again, I started in the space in 93 where companies like Yahoo and Google, they all had nonsensical type names for their company names as opposed to having a name that says what they do, you know, like lend money or something like that. Instead of having something that kind of spells out what you do, traditional .com companies always had that nonsensical name. So it kind of went with the whole theory and of everything, so we decided to stick with Anora.io.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, so tell us more about your company.
Sure. So Anora, essentially Anora is designed to help companies do what we did. You know, we were having problems with fraud. I knew enough about fraud to know what was going on, so I knew what I was being attacked by. Most people today don't have any idea that the issues that they're facing are fraudulent related, and they're literally watering down their ROIs. So essentially our goal is to help them uncover exactly where fraud's coming from, eliminate it to give them an improved ROI. So if you have a company, for example, that does lead generation, right? One of the things that you'll see is that they'll get a lead generated. They say, great, I got a conversion, so I'm happy. Let's continue to do more of that marketing. Then it gets into the hands of the call center. The call center picks up and makes a phone call to the lead, and the person on the other end of the phone swears up and down they never filled out a form. So a lot of people relate this to, oh, it's a fat finger mistake. Somebody mistyped in the phone number. But that's not the case. A lot of these companies will subscribe to services to make sure that the name matches the phone number, which also matches the email address, to make sure they have the right data when they're calling, and yet they still get people who swear they didn't fill out the form. What's happening, we've uncovered and we're able to identify definitively, is when a fraudulent human, so we call them human fraud farms from around the globe, they log into these websites, they go through the path so that they're going to get paid their marketing dollar. They come through that path, they take stolen information, so let's say they take your information, they fill out a form unbeknownst to you, submit it, the marketer thinks they just got a conversion, so everything looks good, but yet it was a false conversion. So we can actually, our software is advanced enough to identify that type of fraud, which affects most performance-based campaigns. So you look at like lead generation, you're looking at e-commerce transactions. We can identify that stuff with accuracy and thoroughness that is unmatched in our marketplace.
Excellent. Now, when we talk ad fraud, are we talking Google PPC ads and stuff like that that are used in search engine optimization also?
It's actually used on any marketing. Anytime you're paying somebody to do something, cheaters will find a way to cheat your system. So if you're on Google, if you're on Yahoo, if you're on Facebook or any of the social networks, if you got an affiliate marketing network that you're having developed the traffic for yourself, if organic traffic even has some fraudulent activity in it, thanks to some advanced bots that are in the marketplace, pretty much any way you drive traffic to a digital asset has the potentiality of having fraud. Now, granted, if you're doing affiliate marketing, programmatic display, you're going to be on the higher end of that level of fraud. If you're going to be buying stuff from tier one companies like a Google or a Facebook, you tend to have less, just because the bigger companies tend to spend a lot more money on fraud detection themselves. But there's still fraud available. There's still fraud to be found. And, of course, if you have fraudulent activity attacking your campaigns, you're going to see without knowing yourself, you're going to see a watered-down version of the ROI. If you identify the fraud, stop buying it, you'll automatically see a lift in conversion rate. And, of course, if you have a lift in conversion rate, you can grow your company faster. And that's really what the heart of what Anora is designed to do.
Okay, excellent. Sounds excellent. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well? Are you just offering your services here in the U.S.? It sounds like you could really be doing this like all over the world, pretty much virtually, am I correct?
Yeah, we have customers all over the globe. So, I mean, we have Ireland, we have Barbados, we have China, Singapore. We have clients all over the world, especially in the U.S., obviously, because that's, you know, we do a lot of trade shows in the U.S. But, no, we can help customers anywhere in the world because a fraudulent user looks the same no matter where you are. We know what to look for. We've been collecting data for the last 15 years globally, so we know exactly what to look for and how to identify it.
Okay. Now, who is your typical customer base like? Are you trying to target the Fortune 500 or small to medium-sized businesses, or is it kind of a mixture of both? Really, I think anybody could really use your services personally. Am I correct?
Yeah. we targeted pretty much any company that spends money in marketing. Now, we're an enterprise class software, so we typically focus on clients that have a minimum spend each month of about $50,000 or managing $50,000 or more, just because the ROI works out very well. If we're finding an average of 25% fraud on a client, which is typically what we find. So if you figure you have if you're spending $50,000 a month, you have a potential of $12,500 in fraud that we can help you eliminate, you know, and we charge a few thousand dollars for the service, it's very easy to see how we can help that client, you know, save more than they spend with us. And that's really our biggest play with customers. You know, the more you spend, the more you're going to be able to save, you know, with a software like ours. So we focus 100% on making sure that we cover our costs through the amount of fraud that we're finding and help them grow their company by fixing the fraud problem that they're having.
Yeah, excellent. Now, I'm at your website right now, and I see that you have, I think, two distinct service lines, a NeuroScript and a NeuroDirect. Could you elaborate on those in a little bit more detail, please?
Sure. They're both, when our clients sign up, they have access to both methods of integration, and it's really just an integration component. They're very flexible, but they're very basic integration points, so they're easy to integrate, but they're very flexible in how they can be used. So a NeuroScript, for example, is the one that we highly recommend everybody use because it collects hundreds of points of data on a user to determine fraud. So with all that data, we can find the most amount of fraud, especially the more advanced levels of fraud. You need a system like that to collect all that data to be able to determine if it's real or fake. Then we have some users who unfortunately don't touch the user. Maybe they get data posted to them or they get it in such a way where they can't expose the user to a piece of JavaScript code. Then we recommend the Anora Direct, which is a REST API, a very powerful tool in identifying fraud. It only uses 2 points of data, and its response time is 7 milliseconds. So it's extremely fast and great for, like, click processing and things that are time-sensitive.
Okay. Excellent. Now, how much money is ad fraud costing advertisers?
Well, it's funny. I just did a talk on that lead generation world in January, and I wanted to actually put a report together, you know, put together a couple of charts and graphs showing the growth of fraud. And for the last couple years, leading up to 2018, it was pretty stagnant, probably around 6 to 7 billion with a slow growth a year that's being stolen from marketers. And then in 2018, it jumped to almost $20 billion. And last year, it was reported to be $42 billion. So in the last 2 years, it's really started to spike up hard, and it's expected to reach $100 billion by 2023. So we're talking some heavy, heavy growth, and that'll represent roughly 25% of the global spend in digital marketing.
Wow. Now, who is committing ad fraud? Is this more of a homegrown threat here in the U.S., or is it done, like, by these nation-state threat actors like North Korea, you know, China, Russia, what have you?
It's funny. It's difficult when done right to predict exactly where these fraudsters are coming from because they do a lot of hiding and network hacks to hide where they're coming from truly. And I get this question asked along. I want to be able to put a pinpoint. I want to name the person who's committing ad fraud. And it's a $42 billion problem with technically no laws against it. So essentially anybody and everybody who's got technical skill and the mindset to do devious things has access to do it. But if I had to pinpoint a single group, I would point it to organized crime. They're using this as go back in the early days. You know, you wanted to commit crime, you wanted to steal money, you hold up a, you know, stagecoach, you know, with a gun, grab the gold and off you go. And then as technology grew and things changed, it became a bank, you know. So now you have to walk inside of a bank. It's got all the security and it's got all the stuff, and you'd have to figure out how to rob a bank if that's what you wanted to do. So then it became easier to just pop a firewall and go behind, you know, different networks and steal information through credit cards or through banking that way. And, of course, there's heavy laws against all that. But now you have this thing called ad fraud, which, like I said, $42 billion last year was stolen. There's no laws against it. So it makes it very easy for the criminal-minded to go after that kind of stuff. But if I had to pinpoint a single group, I'm going to point it back to organized crime from what we've seen time and time again.
Okay. Now, can you differentiate for our audience, please, what an advertiser versus an ad fraud ecosphere is, and how is your company in your position to serve both segments?
So you're talking about an advertiser versus, would you say, an ad fraud?
Ecosphere, yeah, or environment, yeah, ad fraud.
Well, the advertiser is technically the one paying for the advertising, right? It doesn't matter if they're going through an advertising arm, their own internal marketing department or media buying person. You know, at the end of the day, the advertiser, the brand, is actually the one spending the money for the advertising. Ad fraud, they're targeting those dollars. That's where the money comes from. So they're trying to find ways of attacking those dollars. Now, in order to get access to those dollars, they have to go through some type of program where they're getting paid. Now, it could be as simple as programmatic, for example. So programmatic display, you see banner ads all over the internet. And in order to put those ads on sites, people are paying, you know, a percentage of what they collect on it. So let's call it 50%. If they're getting paid 50% of the ad revenue to place an ad unit on a website, somebody there has the ability that if they have fraudulent websites to be able to steal that money because they have access to the money that way. But they, again, in order to understand ad fraud, the way it works, in order to trick the advertiser into continue to paying for it, especially the growth we've seen over the last couple of years, what happens is, let's say an advertiser is paying for display advertising, and they're paying so many dollars for every 1,000 views that are being shown. And the fraudster has access to that through one of their fraudulent sites. So they can pump fraudulent traffic through there and make it look like real impressions when it's not and get paid. The problem is, a good marketing manager or a programmatic system is going to realize, hey, you generated all these impressions, but no clicks and no conversions. So what ends up happening is the fraudster understands this. In order to keep their, call it the gravy train, alive, they have to produce some type of results. So if they show so many impressions, they know they have to generate some bogus clicks that have to look real. And they know if they generate so many clicks, they have to generate so many back-end conversions to make the campaign owner or make the advertiser realize it's working for them. So they have a lot of work to mimic real traffic in a way that doesn't get caught. Because if it gets caught by a system like ours, obviously we're going to take away the ability for them to make money. So they have to come up with ways to try to consistently get past a system in order to continue to get paid. So again, going back to the original question, the advertiser is the one that's paying the marketing dollars, and the ad fraud ecosystem is the one benefiting by stealing those dollars using their crafty ways.
Gosh, thank you. Now, how does your ad fraud solutions work in general terms?
Sure. Essentially, there's a lot of different companies in the market. They all focus on what I consider vanity metrics, right? Different things like viewability or NHT, IBT, SIBT. There's all these different terms that are out there to try to say the word fraud. With us, we're really focusing on the user that's in front of the content. Is this a real person? And what we've come up with is a solution that basically scans their user environment, collects hundreds of points of data, and is looking for digital footprints of alteration. So not a great example, but an example that I think makes a lot of sense is looking at a forged $100 bill. If you had two $100 bills sitting next to each other, one was real and one was fake, the average person probably doesn't know how to tell the difference between the two bills, especially if it's a good fake. However, to the trained eye who knows what data points to look at on the bill can pinpoint the real one versus the fake one. You know, the red and blue fibers, the embedded certificate, the ink doesn't dry, the feel of the paper. There's all these different things that they can use. We have the same situation. When a user lands on a website or a web asset, all the data we collect, we know what it's supposed to look like. We know how each of those data points interact with each other and how they're supposed to look. And by identifying those digital footprints of alteration, that they've done something to forge this particular visitor, we can identify that positively and respond back and let the client know in real time, this is not a real user, so they can make a decision in real time what to do with that user.
Okay, now, are all of your solutions, are they cloud-based? Do you make use of AWS or Microsoft Azure? Or what other platforms, networks, or what other assets do you make use of to leverage these services to your customers worldwide?
Yes, we definitely take advantage of cloud computing. It just offers the ability for easy scalability, especially as we bring on larger clients. If we use a traditional ISP, you can still do it, but there's a lot more delays. Like if you're going to add, you know, a dozen servers to a mix, you know, that takes time. That takes, you know, could be days, could be weeks, depending on the service provider. Inside of cloud computing, like an AWS, you can literally deploy those servers within minutes. So for a scalability concern, it's definitely worth it having everything in the cloud.
Okay. Now, I don't know. Now, it seems like you serve a very unique market space here with ad fraud detection. How big is the market, and what separates you from the rest of the crowd? So, for example, if I'm a customer and if I'm doing, like, PPC ads, why should I say, hey, Rich, I want to come to you versus the rest of the pack? What makes you different from everybody else?
Well, what makes us different is the fact that most, in fact, all the competitors that are in the marketplace right now have built a solution to sell and license. So if you look at when they started building their product and what they did with it, they built it and licensed it right away. Their sole goal was to basically build a company around fraud detection. With us, we built it for ourselves to solve our problem. And our problem was based on performance-based campaign data. So what's different about us is every one of our rules and heuristics is always benchmarked against true performance-based campaign data. Because if we know that we're solving the problem for a performance-based campaign, we know it's going to work well in the other markets. A lot of the competition, what they focus on is vanity metrics. And a great example of a vanity metric that a lot of advertisers are sold on is one called viewability. Viewability is based on some truth. You know, I want my ad to be seen. You know, so if we're talking about an ad unit, you know, a banner, you want to make sure that that ad unit is in front of somebody. So a metric was developed called viewability, and it's focused to customers selling, hey, you want to buy viewable ads because you want your ad seen by somebody. And everybody says, yeah, that makes sense. But then most people who buy on that have no idea what the true definition of viewability is. So according to IAB, which sets the standards for all this, it's viewability is basically looking at minimum 50% of the ad unit would be in view for at least 1 second. So that puts you in a situation where if you saw half an ad for 1 second, does that get the message across? It's probably not what the advertiser is looking to pay for, you know. So what happens is that metric is very easily beaten or defeated by a lot of the fraudsters in the marketplace, so they can make their ads look viewable when they're really not. And the funny thing is, when you're talking about fraud, viewability doesn't say that a real person is viewing your ad. It just says that it's in view. That's the definition. I'll give you an example. I had a Fortune 100 company on the phone with me, and we were discussing ad fraud and how things work and the viewability metrics because he brought it up. So I said, all right, let me send you over an ad. I want you to tell me. Now, you're going to have more than 1 second to look at it, but I'm going to send you half an ad, and I want you to tell me who the brand is. So I sent him the ad, and I said, look at it. And he says, I'm looking at it, and I'm still not sure who it is. I'm like, but now you get it. Then again, you spent more than a second looking at it. So you're already beyond the metric that needs to be met. And he still couldn't figure it out. So I sent him the other half of the ad, and he was embarrassed. He said, I'm embarrassed because it's my own company. You know, they were a Fortune 100 company that had dozens and dozens of brands and probably tens of thousands of different campaigns running with different ad creatives. Of course, he's not going to know his own brand. But I said, now take that ad, and you sent that to me, and I saw that. You paid for me to look at that ad, but I have no clue who it is. If you have no idea who it is, I'm not going to have any idea who it is. So, again, a lot of the competition in the marketplace sells based on a viewability standard, which really doesn't solve the problem of fraud. In fact, I'll give you one more example. There was an article, and I believe it was 2016, 2017, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of the company who did this study, but they were using one of the big boys in the marketplace for ad fraud, and they were spending something like $100, $120 million a month in digital marketing based on this one sector of their business, and they wrote an article out. They were going to take the fraud company was telling them that there was 20% of the traffic was bad. So they said, we're going to take the 20% that they're giving us, and we're going to slice it out so we stop paying for that 20%. Theoretically, we should have the same number of conversions, so our ROI should go up is what we're expecting. They went ahead and pulled the 20% out, and they saw their conversions drop 20% as well. So they concluded that the fraud solution wasn't doing the job. It wasn't accurate because it was basically just mixing good traffic, you know, basically mismarking good traffic as bad and bad traffic as good, to the point that following their advice made no benefit to their ROI. Our solution is focused 100% on improving ROI for our clients. We have clients reporting 20-25% increases in ROI since using our service. And that's what we care about most, is being able to improve the campaign performance. So that's why we kind of focus on the performance-based sector over any other client in the marketplace, because they'll see the difference right away.
Okay. I was just wondering, do your services, your software services, do they make use of artificial intelligence perhaps to keep kind of...
We have some rules in our system that are self-learning, that are automatically updating themselves in real time to be able to stay ahead of the pack. Some of these rules have been written 8-10 years ago and constantly get updates as we see new ways of improving them. We have some machine learning behind the scenes that helps us to identify anomalies in the data that maybe we're missing, because we're collecting billions of requests a day, and that's a lot of data for a single person to go through, you know, for a single team to go through. So we take advantage of machine learning to kind of run through the data for us on a regular basis and point out things that it doesn't understand. And then we can take that information, either add or adjust a rule, or, you know, and then if it's a legitimate case, then we can train the machine learning to overlook that in the next time it sees it. So we have a way of taking advantage of machine learning to improve our process as a whole. And it just makes our job a little easier.
Okay. Now, how do you categorize the fraud that your company finds? I mean, what kind of categorization schemes do you have, or what kind of variables do you use?
Yeah, good. Good question. If you look at our competition, again, always go back to our competition. Our competitors typically use a numerical scoring system based on confidence. So in other words, a request comes in, they start, you know, running through rules and heuristics and coming up with a score and saying, out of a score of 100, this scored 70. And if you read the documentation, it'll say, that means 70% of the time they are confident that it's fraud, or at a 70% confidence level that it's fraudulent. My biggest question is, what about the other 30%? Isn't that possible that it could be real? And therein lies where the false positives happen. For us, we don't want to block something unless we're 100% certain. So when something comes through, instead of giving somebody a numerical score that maybe when it's 70% or 80%, 90% of fraud, they block it, rather than playing guessing games with a numerical score, companies are paying us to be their fraud solution. We're going to definitively tell them what to do with the traffic. We score on three levels, good, warning, and bad. If we score bad, we are 100% confident it's not a real user. And even though we only score traffic as fraudulent or bad, when we're 100% confident, our clients report that we still find 200 to 300% more fraud than our competition. Well, then we have good and warning. Good and warning represent real people with real conversion value. The only reason why we left warning in is because we found out that our warning category actually accounts for the false positives of our competitors. And some of our clients need that data. So we left it in. Otherwise, by default, it's good or bad traffic.
Okay. Excellent. Are there any other KPIs that you may make use of also? Or?
We have the most advanced dashboard in the industry. I don't care what company you go after, what company's dashboard you look at. Ours has the most detailed analytics. And by saying that, we have, you can drill into any variety of source and campaign data through a campaign and run through a myriad of variables like browsers, operating systems, device types, geography down to the city level, languages, networks, connections, pages, refers. I mean, you have the ability to spin around the data in so many different ways. You can literally get lost in our dashboard. But our dashboard is really designed to let you get in, look at the data, get actionable data, and get out and save you a bunch of time. So when you say, do we have other KPIs that we look at, there's a ton of other things that we can show in our dashboard that we do, but it really comes down to the single most important metric. Is this person interacting with your content real or fake? And that's really what it comes down to. So 90% of our clients, when we return a score of bad, that's the only thing they need to care about because it's not a real user. So get rid of it.
Right. Okay. Now, is there a sample of this dashboard or screenshot that, or even just a demo that your that potential customers can see what it looks like?
Normally, we walk our clients through a demo on the phone because we try to find out. Because again, our dashboard is so intricate that you could literally it's easy enough for the average person to get in and get what they need, but detailed enough for the data junkies like myself. So a lot of times what we try to do is find out their pain points, what they're running into, so that when we show them the dashboard, we can highlight the areas that make the most sense to them. Otherwise, a lot of the stuff gets lost in translation because of the detailness of the dashboard. We have a couple of screenshots I know on our website.
Okay, okay. Now, what happens when you see a big spike in fraud from a certain geographic region, like from a certain browser or certain device apps? Could you expand on that a little bit more detail, please?
Yeah. I'll explain it with a story. I like stories. I had a client that I was talking to, and same thing happened. They had a spike in fraudulent traffic coming from a given source of traffic. He called into support to ask, hey, I'm about to call this guy up and tell him that he's got 40% fraud, but I'd like to have some more details. And I see you see all your details in your dashboard, but can you give me something more about it? So, and he goes, the reason I'm asking is because this is my college roommate. So this is going to be a tough conversation to have. So first thing I told him is, look, rest assured, it's not your college roommate that's trying to screw you. Somewhere along the line where he's getting traffic has got a problem. So we were able to drill down in a couple of seconds inside the dashboard and identify that 90% of the fraudulent traffic was coming from a five-year-old web browser. So we were able to give him that data so he can share it with his partner, his friend. And the friend was able to drill that down and isolate on his end where that traffic was coming from and eliminate it. And what's nice is once they eliminated that, other sources of traffic were able to pick up the pace with cleaner traffic. And, of course, our clients saw a lift in ROI, so more leads coming in the door that were more valuable to them. So it was a win-win across the board.
Okay. Now, what kinds of actions do your clients take when you inform them, hey, there's a certain amount of traffic or what have you that's deemed to be fraudulent? Do you just tell them that, or do you also tell them what kind of remediative actions they should take also?
Just about every client wants to do something different with it. So we offer our clients a real-time signaling system that allows them when a bad actor comes in or a fraudulent visitor comes to their web asset, they get the signal, they can do something with that in real time. They can block them from filling out a form. They can send it off to a different web page or a different landing page so they're not interfering with their resources. So they can block it programmatically. Other clients will use the data to go back to their sources to not pay them for the certain portion of traffic that's been fraudulent. Others will use that intelligence to go to their marketing team to avoid buying that type of traffic. So maybe it's coming from certain partners or from certain, you know, supply-side partners that are driving traffic. They'll be able to use the data in a way that works for the way they do their marketing. So, again, we give them a variety of ways to use the data, and each one uses it a little different.
Okay. Now, how do you test and ensure that the controls are in place and working properly? Do you have is it dependent upon each different client, or is this a uniform set of controls that you have?
With us, a fraudulent user is bad no matter what source of traffic they come through. So we do a lot of benchmarking internally to ensure it's accurate, and then we talk to our clients on a regular basis asking if they've come across anything that doesn't look right to them. And I think in the last 3 years of selling the product, we've had two people come to us where we might have marked a weird source of traffic as bad by mistake. And that's a problem for us because we deal with the performance-based marketing sector. I'll give you an example. We had a client that was booking 30,000 airline tickets a day through their e-commerce platform, and we sat right before the credit card transaction. So if we were just a fraction of a percentage wrong, mismarking real people as fake, we would cost them more in 10 minutes than they spent with us all month. So accuracy is super important to us. So if we have a client that comes back to us and says, hey, I think you may have marked this traffic as bad, We'll ask him for the details. We'll be able to dig into the background, look at all the raw data we collected, and then figure out what went wrong if that was, if we're getting feedback from a client that this is a real conversion. We've had that happen twice, and it was basically because it was a very weird development environment being used by their programmers that kind of looked like it was fraudulent. So our system was acting right, but again, the client wasn't happy, so we were able to make an adjustment globally to affect everybody to account for those rare cases. So that's kind of how we handle that. The other way, too, is we always ask clients if they feel we've missed fraud for some reason or another, give us some information from the dashboard, and we'll drill and find it. We haven't really had anything like that come up in the last 3 years.
Wow, okay. Now, do you have any customer success stories you can share with us or any kind of client testimonials you'd like to share?
We have a ton of them on our website. Probably the best place to go is to anora.io. And inside of our resource section, we have, if you just click on resources, there is a pull down, and you can pull down case studies. And we have a bunch of case studies up there right now. A couple of the big companies to highlight would be Quinn Street, a publicly traded company, one of the largest lead generator providers in the space. In fact, we have a quote on our homepage towards the bottom that talks about we improved their campaign performance for their clients 20 to 25% without making any additional adjustments to their site. Another big client on our site would be Digital Media Solutions. This is a company who's been buying companies up left and right over the last couple of years, and their quote on their case study says, not only do we block fraud, but we help grow companies. And what it goes on to talk about is when they applied it, they were using one of our competitors. They were still getting customer chargebacks. They were still having some issues with fraud. They made the switch to us. They stopped getting client chargebacks. And when instead they were getting clients asking what they were doing differently because they saw their ROIs jump up. And because of that, the client demand increased, which helped grow their company faster. That's a great, great case study to look at. We have another good one up there from Brightbox. This one, they were using another fraud vendor before us. They were convinced that fraud vendors didn't work. They were willing to give us one shot because they really need something to help with the problems they were having. And they actually ran through 18 million requests that they sent us, and they couldn't find a single false negative in the group. So this showed that the accuracy of our system was right where it needed to be. In fact, one of the big things we did for them is they had a senior level executive who was responsible for pulling together all the data and building reports so they can once a week sit down and discuss how to handle what fraud was found, what they can do based on the data that they had. So by implementing our system, they now can jump into a report anytime, day or night, with updated real-time data. And this is saving their company 420 hours a quarter in man hours. So those are just three of the ones that we have posted on the site.
Excellent. Yeah, I just saw that. It looks like you got a lot of good case studies there. Now, we know, and just in general, in the cybersecurity area here, there are new threat vectors coming out, almost on a daily basis. Now, as it relates to ad fraud, what are some of the new techniques that these fraudsters are using versus maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? In fact, did ad fraud even exist that far back?
My first ad fraud that I built was something I called Click Defender back in like 2001, somewhere around there.
Wow.
And essentially what it was a very simple piece of code. It was less than 100 lines of code. I think it was actually about 69 lines of code, if I remember correctly. And all it was at the time, you couldn't mimic mouse movement. No matter how much I tried, I could not move the mouse and make the system make my code understand that the mouse was moving. So I knew that if the mouse was on the screen and movable, that it was a real person. It was very, very basic back then. It was very simple to identify fraud. And then shortly after that, people figured out how to manipulate that as new versions of operating systems came out. So then it got to the point where it's so complex. I'll give you one more example. This was probably 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago. And we're sitting there, and me and my partner were going over some stuff. because we're identifying some fraud on some traffic we were buying, and he clicked on something and he heard click, click. And the two of us looked at each other. I'm like, that's odd. Try that again. He did it again. He heard click, click. I'm like, that's the weirdest thing. Long story short, we identified what it was somebody had built, just to understand, everybody knows what an iframe is basically is. But to understand truly what an iframe is, imagine taking a piece of paper, cutting a small hole in it, and then looking through that hole at a web page behind it, right? So what this person did was made a one-by-one pixel iframe, and then what they did was they stuck it under the pointer of your mouse. So now as you went across the page, they had an invisible page behind that that your mouse was moving. And of course, you're human, so it looks like it's human movement, so it doesn't look like it's, you know, robotic movement. And then when you clicked on something you wanted to click on, you would hear the click. It would take the page underneath it, slide it to a place that they wanted you to generate the false click on, and click again. So what you saw was you're clicking on everything that you expected to see, everything looked good, and then they were clicking on an invisible page that you couldn't see through an invisible iframe that was hidden under your mouse pointer. So you heard click, shortly followed by another click sound. And that was the only indication of that type of fraud. I was, hats off, it was a very advanced, very creative way of doing fraud. Nonetheless, it's fraud. So, of course, we had built a tool to be able to identify and eliminate that kind of fraud. So now you move up to now, present day, what they're doing is human fraud farms, which are the hardest to identify and detect, which is something that we specialize in over anybody else in the marketplace. Is human fraud farms from around the world, they're taking advantage of real people. So there's no bot detections out the window, malware detections out the window. Very difficult to detect this type of activity. And then they're using real people to move the mouse, type things in, and fill things in. It makes it very difficult to identify these people. And that's something that we specialize in today through a long list of rules and heuristics that we have designed specifically for identifying these type of people.
Okay. Now, what kinds of techniques do you foresee that the fraudsters will be using into the future? Is it a quickly evolving landscape, or is it kind of more slowly evolving? What are your thoughts on that?
Anything that we can think of that they're going to be using in the future, we've written into our system. Every time one of our developers comes up with a way to get around our current system, and we actually do that. We have games between the tech guys where one guy is responsible for catching the fraud, another guy is responsible for committing the fraud, and they'll go head-to-head. And then if the guy is able to find a way around our system, and the funny thing is he knows everything we do, which no one else does, right? So he knows all the tricks that we do, and he's trying to get around all of our tricks. When he gets around all of our stuff, then the other guy's job is to sit down and see if he can stop it. If not, the two of them get together head-to-head and work on solving that problem. So it's a constant battle. Everything that we can think of that we've come up with, we've been able to develop into our system to prevent new types of fraud from happening. However, when you have $42 billion a year being stolen from the system, you have tens of thousands of people committing ad fraud, you have a lot of brain power of trying to figure out how to get around the system. So it's one of those things, as we see new stuff happen, our systems are in place to help us identify that there's something new that's happening that we have to look into, and then we look into it. So we try to predict the future, but we also let the future dictate a lot of where our development hours go.
Okay. Now, here's a topic that I'll be writing on actually later in this year. I've got an ebook that's going to be coming out. It's on the Internet of Things. I find this concept to be a very scary proposition. I don't like things being all interconnected with each other. I mean, in cybersecurity, we know that's just increasing, that's the way of increasing the attack surface for the cyber attacker. As we start up the next question, what are your thoughts on IoT, and how does the general expansion of this impact ad fraud? Is it going to make the situation much worse, or what have you?
Well, all right, so two questions there. One, what do I think of everything connected? And it opens up the possibilities of so many cool things that can happen where, you know, it's like the old cartoon character where, you know, the guy steps on the scale, realizes he gains weight, goes out to the refrigerator won't open, you know. Too many things talking to each other, but it produces a lot of cool technology, kind of like we have, there's a lot of things that we have today. You know, walking up to your car, you can use your phone to start your car because you lost your keys or you forgot your keys, but you rarely ever lose your phone. Everyone always has that device with them almost everywhere they go, spend so much time on it. So from the technologist in me, I love the concept of everything being interconnected because it gives you a lot more control over your environment. However, a part of me in the cybersecurity world, seeing all the type of fraud that's being committed, says, oh my God, because every time you roll out a new version of a browser, how many holes are open, how many new ways of getting around, how many new types of fraud can be committed from that? Now imagining, you know, in your house you might have, you know, depending on the size of your family, 4 to 6, 8, 10 different devices like laptops and iPhones or Androids or tablets and stuff like that. But now imagine your doors, your lights, your Alexas, you know, your Googles, you know, the connected devices, the home assistants, your irrigation system, your landscape controls, all this stuff, your pool, all tied into this are all holes or potential holes for security. And people are slapping these devices on left and right. You see recently articles about the guys who had those cameras, automated cameras in their rooms, and they have people hacking into them and talking to their children and record and being able to pull video off of that device inside the bedroom, you know, where it's a great idea to be able to monitor your child through a camera when you're young. It's a lot easier to just to take a quick peek of what's going on than to have to go to a room every time. But now you have another potential hole security-wise into your life. So it's a love-hate relationship with the connected devices of everything being connected. You know, there's good points and bad points. It's just the security of things have to be controlled because you're inviting fraudsters into your home by putting these devices in your home.
Okay. Now, just another question I want to ask you on the side here. Do your clients ever ask you about, like, cybersecurity insurance? Like, suppose they're impacted by ad fraud and they lost a lot of money. Obviously, you know, they think they have a good insurance policy that could be covered. Do you have clients asking about that too, or?
I haven't had any clients ask us about that. They ask us if we have certain levels of cyber insurance, you know, for like outages and things like that, which we do. But they don't ask us specifically if they have an insurance policy about fraudulent activity. We're kind of that insurance policy. I honestly don't know if an insurance policy exists. I'm sure with insurance, they insure everything, right? I'm sure there's probably some companies out there that will cover people if they lose money to ad fraud. But again, you have to define a standard who's going to determine whether it's ad fraud or not. So for us, a lot of our clients not only use us for the analytics to improve their campaign ROIs and everything else, we're kind of their insurance policy to defend against ad fraud. So they know that we're working constantly in finding new levels of fraud and allows them to focus on their business. So we've become more or less that insurance policy for them.
Okay. Now, in cybersecurity, there are tons of, you know, groups out there, but here's one that I've not heard of, the Trustworthy Accountability Group, or TAG. What role do they play in the ad fraud prevention realm of things?
They're a company that's designed for the betterment of the industry, trying to focus on a lot of different initiatives, but focusing heavily on reducing fraud in the marketplace. So you have the ability to go to them and get certified against ad fraud, which we did. So we have what they call the TAG Certified Against Fraud seal, which means in order to get that seal of approval, you have to go to a third-party auditor who spends 3 months auditing all your processes and procedures about what we do, and then they make a recommendation to the TAG board that, yes, we passed all the tests, or we have some things that we have to do in order to be ready for that kind of a seal of approval, and then they sign off on it. And there's only a handful of us companies, ad fraud solution providers, that have the TAG seal of approval. There's probably 150 to 200 companies that have the TAG Certified Against Fraud seal, because you can get that too if you're selling traffic. So let's say if you're selling traffic, you want your clients to know you're taking best practices and you've been validated by a third party for that. they'll basically approve companies like that so that when you're going to buy traffic, you know that they're doing best practices for fraud.
Okay. Now, I see here that you're also certified, as you just mentioned. Now, how do you maintain compliance? I know in the cybersecurity realm and the world here that we have, there's so many certifications and so many ways that you have to, you know, remain compliant with it, so forth. Can you kind of elaborate for our audience what how you have to do to maintain? How do you get it, first of all? How do you maintain it in case you're interested in getting this kind of certification?
Well, for TAG, you go to TAG Group, and go to a website, and you're able to identify the process, the procedure. You sign up for the process and procedure, then you schedule the auditor to come. And then it's a lengthy process and documentation that has to be completed by them and your team. You have to designate a compliance officer who's responsible to maintain the practices and everything else that we certify to. And after that 3-month process, you get approval, basically become TAG's, get your seal. To maintain that seal, you have a process that you have to build and submit quarterly reports to TAG to show that you're maintaining and growing and solving additional problems throughout the year, because at the end of the year, you have to get certified again by the third-party auditor. So what they attempt to do is quarterly audits to make sure you're staying on top of different processes and procedures. And if new things come out that they want you to focus on and drill into, they'll add them to the quarterly audits. So it's a process that you have to maintain, and you have to have somebody in your company designated to do that.
Well, okay. Now, what kind of tangible benefits have you gotten from this certification? Have you, like, an increase in revenue or increased number of customers, or do people just look at you and say, hey, yeah, this guy really knows what he's talking about?
It definitely comes in handy when people are familiar with the TAG Group, knowing that it's not a simple process to get through. And if you get through it, at least you know that you're doing everything you're supposed to be doing to fight fraud. We've gotten a couple of people interested because they're searching for a fraud vendor and they've heard about TAG and they went to TAG to see if we're TAG certified against fraud, because they want to deal with a company that's got reputation, you know, got a good reputation and is following good procedure. So it has helped in the marketing side of things as well.
Okay, excellent. Now, how does TAG benefit from your membership?
The nice thing with us is we're another fraud vendor under the cap that's been certified. So our responsibility to TAG is, as we find new fraud threats that have significant value, and there's a whole process on how that's done, we get to report that to TAG, and TAG can disseminate that information across the group. So it becomes a mini community on trying to help each other stop fraud. So while there's a handful of competitors in the space, there's a lot more people, businesses that are focusing on best of practices for fraud detection, and if we have information that we can share, we respond to the group and share that information, and then in turn they allow us to present that information to the group. Sometimes they'll do webinars around it if people are interested in learning more about it, so they help us. So it's like we both help each other grow and stay on top of fraud.
Okay, excellent. Now, this certification, being a member of TAG, will this help, like, in your expansion plans for Anira? And for that matter, are you planning to expand your company?
Well, we're constantly growing the company. As we're bringing on new clients, we need, you know, additional support reps, additional sales reps, additional developers. You know, as a company grows in revenue and in clients, we need to grow the company in order to keep up with growth and expandability. So TAG helps a little bit in that area, because as clients come and check us out, they're looking for, you know, why should I use you? Client case studies are probably our number one tool, because they want to know what other clients are using. And we have a lot of the big names in the space, so if they see somebody, a lot of times they might know who that person is and they can just pick up the phone and call them. That's one thing. And then having a third-party audit done on your company, you know, it gives just more proof to a client that's coming on board that we're doing things right. We're doing things the way they're expected to be done. In fact, I know that when we got our TAG audit, the auditor said we were the first company to come out of the audit without a single recommendation. We were doing everything above and beyond expectations, so which was great for us to hear.
Excellent. Now, does the federal government make use of your services?
No, not yet. We are a GSIA certified company, which means we're on the ticket so that people in the government want to work with GSA certified companies that they can work with us. But we really haven't gone into the government market selling. We've been focusing mostly on the digital marketers, performance-based marketers.
Okay. Now, given all the players in the ad prevention space, and we just talked about TAG, and if there are other groups which I'm not aware of, please mention them. Do you think ad fraud will ever be eliminated, or it's just something that's just going to just kind of be like a coronavirus, it's never going to go away, it's always going to be there? It might be mitigated more to a certain degree, but it's never really end truly.
That's an interesting question. I believe as long as you're paying people on the internet to do something, cheaters are going to always find a way to cheat the system. And as new versions of browsers and new pieces of hardware come out, there's always going to be loopholes. You just can't get around it. When you're talking millions of lines of code inside of an operating system, or you know, hundreds of thousands of lines of code in these new browsers, as they roll out new features, they always, without you know, unbeknownst to themselves, roll out additional loopholes on how to get around the system. So as long as we're going to continue to see upgrades in hardware and software over our, you know, throughout our career using our tools, there's always going to be loopholes, and I believe there's always going to be a way ad fraud's going to be able to find its way into the ecosystem.
Okay. Now, is the percentage of fraud stable? Is it going to grow? Is it going to shrink? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, like I said, we talked about the growth where in the last, prior to 2018, fraud was sitting right around $6 or $7 billion with a slow growth. And then out of the blue in 2018, blew up to almost $20 billion. Last year was $42 billion. And then by 2023, it's expected to be $100 billion. So right now, for the foreseeable future, over the next couple of years, we see it exploding. And I think it's important. Some people are using these tools that talk about viewability. They think they're protected because they don't have all their traffic is viewable. Meanwhile, there's a lot of fraud going on underneath the hood. So right now, for the foreseeable future, I do see it expanding.
Okay. Now, just two last questions before we wrap up our show here. Just in general, how do you foresee the cyber threat landscape evolving here? Now we have the coronavirus. What kind of impact do you think that's going to make on ad fraud, and how is this all going to play out, do you think?
Well, one trend that we have seen is now that a lot of people are working from home temporarily during this coronavirus, more people are spending more time online, but whether it's just browsing the internet or, you know, doing their work from home. So one of the things we have noticed is an increase in traffic across the internet based on the clients that we're tracking, and we're starting to see the fraud ramp up faster because what we see is all fraud, any fraudulent traffic tries to mix good traffic with bad traffic. You know, their basic formula is let's send some good traffic to a source, make sure we get approval and we're up and running and they're giving us their best demand, and then start leaking in the fraudulent traffic and increasing the percentage and see how far we can go before we get caught. And they're going to try to mix in as much junk traffic to their real traffic as possible so they can make more money but still not get caught and shut down. So as we're seeing more and more real traffic hit the network, we're starting to see fraud increase more and more and start taking advantage of that as well. So that's one of the things that we do see happening right now.
Okay. Now, finally, what do you recommend for businesses and individuals just to protect themselves in general from being a victim of a cyber attack or, you know, what have you, and really for ad fraud for that matter? You have a laundry list you kind of tell the customers or clients? Or
I tell them to watch the most important thing. First question I always tell them is you need to use an Aura. We're going to help you solve the problem, right? But outside of that, watch your numbers. There's a lot of data that you have flowing through your network. Performance-based marketing data is going to be the ultimate source of what's going on. And you really need to be able to monitor how much fraud is happening, which, you know, if you're generating leads or conversions, which conversions are being charged back, which leads are being returned because the person never filled out the form, relating all that information back to your marketing data and being able to put that together fast enough so that, you know, if you're paying a source out for traffic, you're getting that data to the right team before you pay out on it. I mean, there's such a myriad of data that you have to pay attention to, stuff we've been doing for the last 15 years. It's just, there's a lot to go through. In fact, I just got off the phone with a client who tested us out a couple months ago, decided he was going to do it himself. So he's been doing it himself for the last couple months. And with the coronavirus, more people working from home, so he's got more work on his plate. And he realized he just can't do it himself. And our data was accurate. He was happy with what we were doing. So he just said, just sign me up and just let's get going again. So it gets to the point where you're going to want somebody who's focused on this level of activity 100% of the time, because you have enough going on with your business to you don't want to be distracted by fraud.
Okay. Well, Rich, we thank you for your time today this afternoon, and we hope to have you again on a future podcast.
I appreciate it. Thanks again.
Thanks for your time. Take care and stay safe.
You too. Thanks.
Bye. It's done.